Hello and welcome to the September 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspapers monthly magazine. I'm Fran Frank and this month I am joined by Camilla Taylor as co-presenter.
Hello everyone. Hope you have all made the most of a rather changeable summer. I think we ought to apologise for this edition being somewhat later than usual, but a number of our team members have been away on holiday, so today's recording had to be pushed on a bit. But now we are all back, let's start with a few details about things that have happened in previous Septembers.
Thanks for that, Camilla. September has always been quite busy, with a number of local fairs and outdoor events scheduled to take place. But as this recording won't actually be issued until the middle of the month, I think we will start with 15th of September 1890, when Agatha Christie was born in Torbay. Those of you who enjoy her novels will probably know that Torbay usually organised quite a few events during this time of the year to celebrate not only her birth, but all of the novels that she wrote during her lifetime.
16th September 1620 was the date that the Mayflower ship departed from Plymouth, bound for the Americas. However, due to the pandemic in 2020, most of the events that had been organised to commemorate this in and around Plymouth were postponed or even cancelled. Shame for the organisers, but I think something called COVID came along.
Don't remind us, Camilla. September the 19th last year was the state funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, who died on the 8th of September at Balmoral, aged 96. Although it was a very sad occasion, especially for her family, we as a country, together with thousands of people around the world, watched as the Queen's coffin was taken with great dignity through the streets of London back to Windsor Castle.
Another notable event for September 19th took place in 1893, when New Zealand became the first country in the world to grant women the right to vote.
The next fact actually relates to what we are doing right now. On 25th of September 1690, the first American newspaper was published in Boston, Massachusetts. I wonder if anyone thought about producing an audio version.
No, I don't think anyone had invented the technology then. But here is another early achievement that listeners may find interesting. On September 25th, 1818, James Blundell carried out the first transfusion of human blood at Guy's Hospital in London. I notice in the records that they don't give the gentleman the title of doctor or professor, but maybe in those days he might have been someone who just donated his time and knowledge to help others. We will never know.
What a lot of facts and figures we seem to have squeezed in already. I wonder if we ought to let the listeners know what we have in store for them as far as articles are concerned. We have John Townsend in conversation with Jenny Jenkins in what is entitled as Jenny's Secrets. This is followed by an article from Valerie about an upcoming site conference, then a book review from Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald.
Aileen Clarkson provides one of her letters from a dog walker. Harry Sullivan recites a long-forgotten poem. Fran has found an interesting item about flying objects. And David Quay will talk about his experiences in North London compared to his current life here in South Devon.
There will also be a couple of pieces of music along the way, so let's get going with this month's secret interview.
Hello, I'm John Townsend, and my guest this week is very familiar. In our 8 years of Roundabout, we must have featured over 100 interviews with all manner of interesting local people, and lately Jenny Jenkins has been on the prowl among Here and Now contributors to discover more about the person behind the voice in her Jennifer Meet series. But we're taking a break from her asking the questions and from my Performing Arts Devon dialogues for a special one-off. As for Roundabout's 8th birthday, no less, I turn the tables and give Jenny a dose of her own medicine. After all, we know her delightful voice, but what secrets might lurk beneath those mellifluous tones? So it's my pleasure to be invited here into Jenny's Riviera penthouse, where, like Barbara Cartland engulfed in a cloud of pink chiffon, she is draped on a velvet chaise longue, ready to tell all. Welcome, Jenny, or perhaps you should welcome me.
Well, no, I think you're welcoming me and I'm welcoming you. Should we just get on with it?
Yes, shall we? Yes. Yes. Of course, she's not really draped on a chaise longue. We're going to stick to the truth, aren't we, Jenny?
Nothing but the truth. Oh, of course.
Yes. Well, OK, I thought I shall do my best to winkle from you only the absolute truth. But unlike your interviews, I thought I'd make our chat more of a sort of a tease, a quiz, for listeners to guess the facts before you reveal all. So let's start with this little teaser. Quiz one. Only two of the following are true, but which are they? Which of these did Jenny really achieve? One, riding a penny farthing for a mile in the 1947 Tunbridge Wells Carnival. Two, flying planes and passing her assistant pilot certificate. Three, milking a yak while staying in a Himalayan temple. Or four, qualifying as a scuba diver and descending into exotic waters. So while listeners decide which of those are true and conjuring up this image of you doing all of these things, can I ask you, Jenny, to take us back to your early memories, maybe your earliest memories of growing up in London during the war, I believe?
Well, you're right. I was born in Lewisham and I was three when the war started. And I have still very vivid memories of any child who was around at that time in those situations. I never felt frightened because my father particularly always tried to explain what was happening when we were looking out of the air raid shelter at the planes up in the skylights. That was very clear. But I did get sent off to a boarding school instead of being evacuated because my parents had a business. And again, I still got vivid memories of that, of being taken down to the cellars when there was an air raid. I'm still friends with one of the girls I went to school with. And I was there till I was seven. And then when it got a bit hotter, my parents had the attitude of we all go together. Hmm. So I went back home when I was seven and went to school in Peckham, going by my own by tram every day from Lewisham to Peckham to the school there.
And you did witness many an air raid?
Yes, under the desks at school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our road was completely, you couldn't drive down it, and the places where houses used to be in the night, the following morning, piles of rubble. Yeah. I used to collect shrapnel.
Oh.
My mother, you know, bent metal. You're not bringing that in here, it's from a German...
And I believe you were about eight and you moved to Tunbridge Wells?
That's right. For health reasons, my father had to give up his engineering career, sadly. He bought a bicycle shop in Tunbridge Wells, which was a big change from London.
Yeah. So would this explain why I put, as one of the choices, back to the quiz, you rode a penny farthing for a mile in the 1947 Tunbridge Wells Carnival?
No, I don't know where you got that from, but I do know somebody who did.
So that's not the true one. Well, let's remind listeners of the other things, and two of them are true. Did you fly planes? Did you milk a yak? Or did you qualify as a scuba diver?
Well, we'll rub out the yak. haven't done that yet.
You haven't done that yet.
No.
But, so you're telling me you have flown planes?
Well, after I met Graham, I would say my current husband.
Yes.
He was a pilot, and we used to have a share in an aeroplane and fly off to France and have a jolly time. Halfway across the channel one day, I thought, what do I do if anything happens to Graham and I haven't blown up the dinghy? We didn't have parachutes and little aeroplanes, just a dinghy. So we decided I should take my assistant pilot's course, which I did. And I flew much more happily then, knowing at least I could land and take off.
Fantastic. So, well, I don't think listeners, I certainly didn't know this was one of your skills. So are you also saying you've been a scuba diver in your time?
Well, that was earlier on when my daughter took up scuba diving. And I thought, I'd like to do that. So I was in my probably my late 40s, and then I was in my 50s when I did the flying. So, game girl, really, aren't I?
Yes, Wonder Woman, I've said. Yes, brilliant. Well, let's move on a little bit, shall we? So you've you were in Tunbridge Wells growing up, and I think you then went on to train as a nurse, is that correct?
That's right. I wasted my education, sadly, because I'd rather have been a doctor. But my teacher said, you'd go and be useful. So I became a nurse, and I managed to get into Charing Cross Hospital, which was the nearest one to Tunbridge Wells on the railway line.
Right, and probably a very busy one.
Oh, it was very busy in central London. It's the old one that was in the Strand, but by the station.
Wow.
And we had the benefit of going out to other hospitals for different sorts of training, such as TB and that sort of thing.
I see. So you must have come across some quite well-known people. And I'm now going to do a little name-dropping, because I had a little chat with Jenny earlier. And, well, this is the next quiz question, quiz two. While she was in Charing Cross and other hospitals in London, which of these did she not meet? Joe Brown, the pop singer? 2, Sean Connery, the first James Bond? 3, Tommy Steele, the famous performer and film star? 4, Gilbert Harding, journalist and broadcaster, chair of What's My Line? Now then, as listeners decide, I ought to let you know that all four actually do have some kind of Jenny connection. So Jenny, let's go through them. Do tell us. Joe Brown.
Well, I didn't actually see him, but I was on night duty at Harefield Hospital, and as I came on duty, I went to put the visitors' chairs away, and they were all the girls on the ward said, "Don't touch that chair." "Why, what's wrong with it?" "Joe Brown put his foot on it." "Oh, sorry, I'm the wrong person. It was Tommy Steele." "Tommy Steele."
"Oh, Tommy Steele. Okay, well, no, all these." "Tommy Steele." So
I'm so excited.
So, okay, so Tommy Steele was in the hospital and everyone was... This was the height of his fame, I suppose.
Yes, Tommy Steele was one of the nurse's boyfriend at the time, so he'd come in. But I only heard he'd done that.
Yes.
Going back to Joe Brown, that was a little later on in my life, where I saw him, he was being filmed, and he was riding a bicycle around a cinema car park, and I was enthralled because I thought he was wonderful. Joe Brown loved his music, and all I could do was gasp with admiration. So again, I was just a bit soft on him.
I think he's still doing tours
and
things.
He's wonderful.
Still
think he's marvellous. Right.
Well, what about Sean Connery? Is that a red herring?
No, I did actually meet him again when I was at the Cross, and we all hung out in coffee bars when we had our off duties, and I met him, but James Bond hadn't been invented then.
Oh.
At this time, he introduced himself to me over a cup of coffee and later as Tam Connery, and he was appearing in South Pacific, I think it was, in the Chorus at the time.
Oh.
So we used to go out together, but difficult with my shifts.
Yes.
And we shared love of poetry. And
he'd
pick me up on his Vespa with a big hat on. He did, not me, and off we go in that.
Yeah.
So he was quite attracted to my black stockings at the time. I don't know why. He had a hang up on nurses,
well,
I think.
You could have been the very first Bond girl, couldn't you? I suppose the other extreme, I don't know if listeners will remember Gilbert Harding, who used to be on television and was a journalist, but what was your connection with him?
Oh, I was working on the male ward, surgical ward at the Cross, and I came on to do something at his bedside, and I was feeling a bit weepy because at that time, just beforehand, matron had nabbed me for wearing lipstick on duty.
Good heavens.
And she marched me into the sluice room, got a bit of paper and made me scrub it off. And also she told me off for wearing my big butterfly cap, like a Glengarry cap, and she replaced it on my head, a la 1930s and 40s, with just an inch of hair showing this. And she made me go back on duty. And I was so humiliated, A, not to have my lipstick on, and B, to have this old friend. And of course, all the other girls, what on earth are you doing? So I poured this out to Gilbert Harding. Next Sunday in the Telegraph, or Sunday Times column, which he wrote, he stuck up for us nurses. We'd rather see them with a bit of lipstick than being pale and half starved. So there we are. That's my claim to Gilbert Harding.
And probably why you're wearing that wonderful lipstick right now.
Mwah. So. didn't do that, did I?
Okay, well, let's go to question three. So, after a wide range of nursing practices and experiences, Jenny set up her own specialist clinic. So, this is a quiz. What was her specialism? One, babies and toddlers. Two, hypnosis and hypnotherapy. Three, needlework and getting well oiled. Or four, food, fasting and flatulence. Do tell us, Jenny, which of those is your speciality?
Well, by this time I'd been married and had my family, and I had trained as an acupuncturist, and I was qualified when I was 40. And
so that's needlework came into that, very clever.
Yes. And also later on, because I'd enjoyed giving massages as well as receiving them, I decided to become an aromatherapist.
Oh.
So my training was a three-year degree course down in Kent, the International College of Oriental Medicine.
Yeah.
So I really had to know the Chinese methods of everything and way of thinking. And the aromatherapy is just because I like to do it.
And this kept you in full-time work for
many years, I suppose. 10 years full-time practice. I had lots of recommendations from the GPs in the area, passing me on patients that, you know, in those days they didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
There were only 200 of us in 1980 when I qualified in the country. So you're quite a rare breed. Mm. My mother had been the first person I knew who'd ever had it, and I thought it was shocking, you know, fringe medicine.
Yeah.
But she said, well, learn about it before you criticise, dear. Which I did. And
You're very wise.
Well, my GPs respected my probably 30 years of being an SRN, state registered nurse, so I had foot in two camps.
So you were dealing with all kinds of ailments, all kinds of people.
Yeah.
Everything
you could think of that I'd ever had in hospital nursing, from allergies, skeletal problems, delivering a baby using acupuncture.
Yeah, this might sound a silly question. Can you actually use acupuncture on yourself?
No, because if you're sick yourself, you're not thinking properly.
Ah.
You could try and diagnose on the traditional way on the pulses, but I've never needled myself.
No, okay, no, it's just a thought I had.
You could use acupressure.
Right, good. Now, we'll come to the final question, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Having invited listeners to tell us about interesting or unusual places where we have stayed in my series, A Roof Over Our Heads, I asked Jenny about her various places she's stayed, and surprisingly, she once slept in one of these. So, which was it, listeners? Is it one, in a tent among lions, hyenas, and dinosaurs? Well, dinosaur footprints, shall we say. Was it in an igloo among polar bears and Arctic wolves? Or was it in a Torquay beach hut among marauding mods and rockers? Do tell, Jenny.
Well, you can forget two and three, but the first one is correct. I met somebody who'd been on an expedition called Operation Raleigh through my son. And I said, oh, if I were your age, if I was 19, I'd do that again. And the young lady said, well, you can still do it, even if you are 53. You're a qualified nurse, you're a people person, and they're looking for somebody with team leadership. So one day, somebody didn't turn up for an appointment, and I found the form, filled it in, and lo and behold, in April, I was accepted to go as a medic on an expedition. I didn't know then, because they had expeditions all over the world. And it was for young people between 18 and 24, set up by Prince Charles, as he was, and Colonel John Blashford Snell. Uh-huh. So it was to introduce people, inner city children, youngsters from all walks of life, to a different way of living. It was a 3 months expedition, but I had to pass a very strict fitness test, and then all of our staff had to meet up for a weekend of doing impossible things. I thought I was going to die. It was so exhausting, using, you know, sit reps and map reading and all that stuff. Anyway, eventually they said I would be welcome to go on one of their expeditions. Choose where you'd like to go. And on one of the tasks we had to do, I met up with a soldier who'd been to Zimbabwe, and he said it's the most wonderful country in the world.
Mm.
So I said, can I go to Zimbabwe, please? Yeah. When do we leave?
Ah.
And they said, oh, June. Well, this was April, so I had to shut down my clinic, rearrange my home life and everything. And I got there on June the 20th, had various expeditions to different places, doing everything from building a holiday home for the children to taking footprints from the dinosaurs' footprints, cast with paleontologists, working with the most amazing group of youngsters on three or four different sites. In my case, being a medic, I was moved around all over.
And some had lions prowling around.
Definitely. Yeah. But the secret you might like to know to keep lions away from you, we used to get the boys to have a pee all round the boundary at night.
I see.
And somehow they
kept
away.
Kept quite a lot away.
Yes.
Oh, right.
You were going to try it on your vegetable patch.
Yes. Well, we'll see if that works. Oh, that's fascinating. So no regrets about going to Africa and doing that project?
Absolutely not. No. It changed all of our lives, the staff and the young people.
And do they still do that, Operation Raleigh?
No, that changed into Raleigh International, and I think it's a different name now.
Yeah.
But I think the opportunity is still there.
Okay.
And I would recommend anybody. Most of them were sort of up between leaving school and going to uni, or they were doing apprenticeships, but it was wonderful. It changed my life in the fact that at the end of it, by that time, Graham, my husband, had come into my life and we were good friends. And I asked him to, if I could write to him, could he send letters out to the family?
Yeah.
Which he did, and that's another story.
And I understand you, was it the Bahamas you
Well, he actually invited me to go on holiday with him after I came back in September, which I agreed. And then he said, would you like to change your name while we're away?
Wow.
I thought, doesn't he like Jennifer? Anyway, I accepted, and it was out of Africa, into America, popped to the Bahamas, got married on the beach, travelled around America for 3 weeks, came home, still didn't have a home because that was rented out, and I decided to retire then because he said, you don't have to work.
Wow.
Well, so I'm a kept woman.
So, how exotic. And not only that, you probably flew yourself home as well. Talking of your name, Jenkins, I'm very much aware of the clock ticking and we need to move really to the end. And as always, we're inviting you to choose a piece of music. And we were talking earlier and the name Jenkins has cropped up. Would you like to explain why you're choosing the piece that you're going for?
Well, it's a piece of music by a very famous singer, a soprano called Florence Foster Jenkins. And you may have seen the film of the same name. Now, as you know,
with Meryl Streep.
She took the part, and who was the lovely man in that?
Hugh Grant.
That was right, yes.
Yeah.
But rumour has it, being married to a Jenkins now, that could be, maybe there is some link in the family, because, do you know, when Graham sings in the shower, he sounds exactly like her. And this is why I've asked our producer to find a piece of Florence Foster Jenkins music for us all to delight in.
Well, that's...
Thank you for inviting me to choose.
Well, I now look forward to hearing it. And thank you, Jenny, for all your fascinating stories. And in this edition of what I have called Jennifer's Secrets. So thank you.
We'll do version two another time, shall we? Wait
thank
till I
much.
Get you on the questioner's couch. Thank you, and bye-bye to our listeners.
Goodbye.
As her music choice, Jenny chose Florence Foster Jenkins singing Adele's Laughing Song from Die Fledermaus by Johann Strauss II. A note of warning, listeners. Florence Foster Jenkins' rendition of this song may come as a surprise to your sense of hearing.
She knows you need my little white hand so fine.
Valerie Forrester now has some information for us about a local conference.
Hello, this is Valerie. I've just received the Devon in Sight Autumn Magazine. The Devon in Sight Conference, which this year is entitled Making Devon a Sight Loss Friendly Community, will be held this year at the Mercure Rougemont Hotel, Exeter, on Friday, the 20th of October. The tickets are £10. If you would like to attend, please make sure you purchase your tickets before the 29th of September. Cheques are payable to Devon in Sight, and send your cheques to the office manager, Devon in Sight, Splatford Barton, Ken Ford, Exeter, EX67XY. Your ticket will include access to the exhibition, the AGM, and ongoing refreshments and a light lunch. If you want more details, please ring the helpline, which is open between 10 and 2, Monday to Friday, and the number is 01392 876 666. I'll repeat that. 01392 876 666. Hope to see you there. Bye.
Here are Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald with this month's book review.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been reading The Girl in the Red Coat by Kate Hamer. And it actually is one of those books that lived up to its blurb. It was totally engrossing. I read it in 3 or 4 days. It was exciting, gripping. I know everybody won't see it like that, but I did. I was very excited to carry on. I even felt sympathy for most of the characters. One of them rattled a little bit, but I grew into it. I really enjoyed it. All the characters, I felt were truthful. I actually believed in them all. There were some odd ones, which I had to think about a little bit. But now I really enjoyed it. And the characters, for once, all came to be real people.
Okay, yes. So this is the sort of book I don't very often read. It's a psychological thriller. But it's very good. Goodness me, is it very compelling. It is a total page-turner. And it's a quite simple premise. But this is a little girl, aged 8, the girl in the red coat, the name of the book, and she is kidnapped right at the beginning of the book. So I'm not giving anything away by saying that. And so she goes missing. So on the one level, it is just the sheer horror of that situation and the way that the mother particularly adapts to it. But what makes this so clever and makes it so brilliantly done, very well written, is that the chapters alternate between the perspectives of the mother, who's a grown woman, very articulate, intelligent woman, who's just going through hell, and the little girl, who's 8, and is therefore an unreliable narrator about what's happening to her. So we know as the reader, you know as the reader, much more about what's really going on than either of the two main characters. And the entire book proceeds in that way. The mother chapter, the daughter chapter, the mother chapter, the daughter chapter, and takes it through to its end.
Quite often, though, I find that chopping and changing distracting, but I didn't hear at all. It flowed, and it helped me as well to get over the initial feeling that this is going to go bad. This is going to be a horrible child kidnapped person, something awful. But then as it evolved, we realized that it wasn't. It's all about money.
Well, money and religion.
Yes, yeah. But it's the money that comes.
We mustn't say too much, no. Because honestly, I think we both really recommend this.
But that is something you have to get over, I think, in the early stages. And as a female,
yes,
I picked that. Yes. That was an anxiety for me initially. But don't worry, reader, plow on.
That's right. Yeah. So it starts. Yeah, as you start reading it, it could turn into a horror story, but it doesn't. The little girl is kidnapped, and I think we can probably say without giving too much away that she is used but not abused.
Absolutely.
And you understand the perspective of the people who have kidnapped her. There's a lot that's a little bit unexplained. There are areas where I would like to have known more about what was happening and why and so on. But it races along, and it just gets better and better, and by the end it really is very interesting indeed.
And made interesting as well by the fact that the little girl, there's always a hint that she's different, but she's also very coherent in her own thinking, her own quiet looking at things and taking it all in, working things out. And that's what makes it real, because the suggestion that there's something different comes from one of the mother's friends early on, and she discards it. But of course, as you read it, you see that that is a possibility, because this is a development that you're going to know more about.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a sort of fairy story element to it.
Yes.
Which is interesting. But as you said, Mary, the characters are all very believable. Even the sort of villains are believable. You understand where they're coming from, and they're sort of desperation and their misconceptions and so on, and what's going on. And it's you become very interested in them. It's not at all, it's quite a it's a very well written book, I think.
It is. And of course, there's a joyful moment for the lady who assisted in the care of her while she's been captured. The only thing for me that was how did she get to America?
Well, that's right. That's one of the unexplained things.
It is. But yeah. I think it's something that may be overcome if we read it again and think about it. And maybe there's a follow-up. We don't.
Well, there is. There is a sequel. And it's been published earlier this year. And I will certainly be reading it.
I will join you with that.
The book that Stephen and Mary have just reviewed is The Girl in the Red Coat by Kate Hamer. Books are available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobooks. Aileen Clarkson has again been out and about with her little dog, Honey Bear.
Dear listener, after COVID, we experienced a period where some things returned to normality quite quickly and others did not. Gradually, however, I've also noticed that those things which were missing have almost completely returned, like the vapour trails in the sky left by aircraft as they pass over carrying passengers for work or recreation. People sitting among strangers outside and inside pubs and cafes. Spectator sports, street fairs, local buses, trains and ferry boats, crowded and not a mask in sight. Having been someone who was instructed to isolate for the first 3 months of lockdown, I still try to avoid crowds, but I continue to wear a mask only when I enter a hospital for whatever reason. I'm sitting writing this letter to you, propped up in bed with a lined notepad and a pencil. No, I'm not ill. There was nothing I wanted to watch on television, so I came to bed early after taking Honey for an evening stroll. Adaptable as ever, she is fast asleep at the end of the bed, and I detect a soft snoring sound coming from her direction. I'm so lucky that she is happy to fit in, and the only two things in her day she expects to be roughly at the same time are 8:30 a.m. breakfast and 6 p.m. evening meal. She's not too keen on walking in the rain, and made it clear she didn't like the raincoat I bought for her. So over this most unpredictable of summers, I have varied our long walk to suit the weather forecast. When my sister and I were young, we spent the long summer holidays with my Aunt Jean and Uncle Andrew on their small dairy farm on the west coast of Scotland. Laganhooly Farm was set in a valley, and it had a wonderful uninterrupted view towards the Firth of Clyde and the granite island of Ailsa Craig. The island is the original source of curling stones, and we were told that if it had a cloud hat on, it was going to rain, and when you couldn't see the island, it was raining. Luckily, it didn't seem to rain very much, and Marjorie and I loved it. We were free to wander just so long as we took with us the two collie dogs, Flo and Midge, and stayed within the boundary of the farm. Sadly, this year in Devon, during the whole of July and August, there has been lots of rain and a shortage of summer warmth, causing several regular local events to be scaled down or even cancelled. Because it was often wet underfoot, Honey and I stopped visiting Oakland Woods and Fields and restricted ourselves to Mules Park and the town pavement walking. I suppose we have to count ourselves lucky we have not had the searing heat experienced in many parts of the world, which has dried crops and vegetation and resulted in fires and drought. Honey and I would like some heat now, because she went to see Gina yesterday for her regular groom. Gina works from home in a purpose-built parlour, aptly named In the Doghouse. And they obviously like one another, which makes her visits a pleasure for everyone. I'm sure I have told you before that when I return to collect Honey, she always emerges looking shy, thinner, and there is no other word for it, beautiful. If it is possible, Honey loves to come with me wherever I go, and if she has had enough exercise beforehand, she will curl up and sleep happily until it is time to leave. It is good for both of us, however, that she is content to stay at home, alone, if she cannot come with me, and I aim to leave her for no more than 4 hours. This gives me the freedom to visit friends or shop without worrying about her. If the weather does not permit a walk before I leave, I have the perfect solution. The enclosed 12 stairs leading from the kitchen down to the library on the garden level are a perfect location for me safely to throw a ball which Honey runs down after, retrieves and returns to me to repeat the process. 10 or 12 retrievals are usually enough, and after a visit to the garden she is happy to retire to one of her beds to await my return. I am feeling sleepy, so I will say good night and put the light out. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
And now we have Harry Sullivan reciting The Mermaid.
On Brighton Beach some time ago, a boatman by the name of Joe looked up and in amazement saw a mermaid washed up on the shore. His eyes bulged as without delay she rose and, shaking off some spray, proceeded to remove her tail and placed same in a nearby pail. Joe was astonished, rubbed his eyes. The mermaid then, to his surprise, said in a foreign voice, "Ah oui, monsieur, I do not like the sea." From where before her tail had been, a pair of shapely limbs were seen. Joe muttered, "Cripes, this is a case," and could not look her in the face. She said to Joe, "Let's get away. I'm tired of all these waves and spray like jelly bobbing up and down. Monsieur, let's go and see the town." Joe's blushes matched his ginger hair, for mermaids have no clothes to wear. He murmured, "I shall cop it strong if watch committee come along." Some people passed by stopped to smirk. A newsboy shouted out, "Nice work!" More people gathered, quite a jam, and watched them start to board a tram. The tram conductor saw them come and said to Joe, "Oi, knock it, chum." Joe said to him, quiet as can be, "She's just a mermaid from the sea." The tramman said, "Oh yes, old bean, and what are you, the fairy queen?" A policeman hovered into view, took out his pad, said, "What's to do?" The mermaid murmured, "Oh yes, Cindy, I love your lovely English policeman, please." Sad to relate, that copper brave fell for her charms, became her slave, and leaving poor Joe in the lurch, she married the cop in Brighton Church. All she left Joe was the pail containing her discarded tail. Joe, sore at being left so flat, gave it to his lodger's cat.
I don't think I have heard that poem before, have you? The next item comes from Fran and involves strange or unusual items falling from the sky.
Hi there. I picked up the weekend paper and came across the following article, which you may find interesting, as it refers to unusual and in some cases unbelievable items that have fallen out of the sky. Here are just a few of them. Frozen iguanas. The iguanas that live in Florida like to make their homes in the branches of tall trees. However, when it gets too cold, their cold-blooded bodies stop functioning properly and they can no longer hold on to the branch. Freezing iguanas then start falling from above and will stay laying motionless on the ground until the temperature warms up, when they spring back to life. That must be a bit surprising. Fish. There are several theories as to why it sometimes rains fish, which it has done in many parts of the world, including India, Australia, and Canada. One explanation is that it is caused by a whirling column of air and mist called a waterspout. When a waterspout forms above water, it sucks up the fish and other marine creatures from the lakes or the sea before carrying them inland and dropping them on to confuse people holding up umbrellas. The same thing happens with frogs. In 1873, the magazine Scientific America reported a shower of frogs, which darkened the air and covered the ground for a long distance after a rainstorm in Kansas City. The spooky phenomenon known as spider rain is caused by millions of tiny spiders engaging in a behaviour called ballooning. First, the spiders go to an exposed high place. They then release silk threads from their abdomen, which are picked up and carried away by the wind, with the flying spiders coming along for the ride. Ballooning spiders can travel anything from a few metres to hundreds of kilometres. It is a technique mostly used by baby spiders, which are called spiderlings, and they're trying to find new territories. The next couple are a little bit harder if they come down. More than 2,000 working and 3,000 broken satellites currently orbit the Earth. When they stop working, they become space junk. Over the past 50 years, more than 5,400 tons of space junk have survived re-entry and landed back on Earth. Golf balls, just as hard. Residents of Punta Gorda in Florida were left scratching their heads and the bumps on September 1969, when dozens of golf balls dropped out of the sky. The most convincing theory to explain them is that a passing storm had scooped up water from a lake on a local golf course, along with lots of lost balls, before dropping them on the nearby town. Ah, the rain seems to have stopped here. So I think I'll get my coat and see if I can walk around the block, as long as there are no spiders, golf balls, or anything else flying around.
I know the article claimed that all of those details were genuine, but I still have some doubts. Anyway, our last item for this month comes from David Quay, who tells us about the time when he left North London to move to South Devon.
Hello, I'm David. I'm usually a reader with the Red Team. Today I've joined the Roundabout Team as a guest member and occasional contributor. Nearly 20 years ago, for a variety of reasons, I decided to leave North London and come down to live permanently in this delectable part of the world. It wasn't as if I were a total stranger to the area, as I'd done a postgraduate year at the University of Exeter and had enjoyed a couple of holidays in the north and south of the county. I soon realised that I'd like to live in either Dawlish or Teignmouth, and in the event, I found a bungalow that suited me particularly well in Teignmouth. And the rest, as they say, is history. Having been born in northeast London in Hackney, almost, but not quite, I think, a true Cockney, I appreciated that it would be quite a wrench to settle down here, especially as I was coming alone. And truth to tell, it was rather more difficult than even I had imagined. Quite understandably, I missed my family very much, just as I regretted the familiar features of London life with which I had been familiar for over 50 years. For example, the hustle and bustle, the sheer pace of existence there, the entire ambiance of the place itself. It made me feel extremely homesick and certainly very nostalgic. Now, I'll try and recollect a few of my memories now. It's rather like all our yesterdays. Well, there were those red London double-decker Routemaster buses that I missed. The black cabs. The indescribable smell of the tube. Oxford and Regent Streets. The Barbican. The South Bank. Singing carols around the Norwegian gifted Christmas tree in Trafalgar Square. Not to mention the culture by which you are surrounded in any worldwide capital city. I spent many a day in all those museums in South Kensington and in the Barbican, which housed the Museum of London in those days. Then there was the allure of Theatreland in Leicester Square and Piccadilly Circus with their brightly coloured neon lights and a truly breathtaking choice of shows. How I remember Les Misérables and Phantom of the Opera. I even saw The Mousetrap twice, although, being a whodunit, it wasn't as good the second time round. Then there was the city of Westminster with its historic abbey, Big Ben, and further east, the city of London, with the landmark cathedral and pièce de résistance of Sir Christopher Wren, St Paul's, sitting very proudly just a stone's throw away from the original lifeblood of the city, the River Thames. Yes, for me, up there, in the words of the Roger Miller song, England really did swing. And so, one very cold day in January, I drove down to my new home in Tynmouth via the M25, the M4 and the M5. I remember the end of the journey so well, because when I arrived down here, the Christmas decorations were still evident in some of the homes in my little cul-de-sac. It certainly was dark by then, and I felt rather disconsolate, lonely, and, if I'm honest, a tad frightened. But then tomorrow was just a few hours away, and a new dawn would quite literally introduce itself to me. Well, of course, as sure as day follows night, my first day in Tynmouth announced itself and welcomed me to my brand new environment. I didn't know anyone in the town except for an elderly gentleman who had been a tutor of mine at Exeter. Naturally, it felt quite different down here. I realise that that's stating the obvious, but I wanted to embrace my new existence, meet the neighbours, and make new friends as quickly as possible. Now, naturally, that didn't happen overnight. I began to frequent the smugglers, and the staff there became a kind of surrogate family to me, as they did also at the Old Walls Vineyard. I enjoyed walking along the promenade, looking out to sea, nodding to the friendly people and admiring the imposing and awe-inspiring Ness. Then there were visits to the Shaftesbury Theatre in Dawlish, long before the new pavilions was opened in Tynmouth, and excursions further afield to, say, Dartmoor, Exmoor, Tavistock, the Seaton Tramway, the Donkey Sanctuary, Clovelly, and Westward Ho, and so on. I even ventured as far afield as Cornwall, and I have to confess, although I don't do so very often, that I always put my jam on a scone before the cream, just like they do in that other county. I've always been interested in railways, and the proximity of Dawlish Station to the sea was a constant source of wonder and awe for me, as was travelling along the line up to Exeter and going through those five tunnels. I never tire of that journey to St David's. And you know what? I never shall. I should also like to add that I co-founded a social group for people of my own age in the Dawlish Tynmouth area, and we enjoyed weekly meetings at the Smugglers for exactly 10 years. And I've been involved with other activities down here. And 7 years ago this month, I joined the Here and Now team. There I found much friendship and would like to thank Val and the late Jonathan and the people I've worked with, especially in the Red Team, for their friendship, companionship, patience on occasions, and sense of fun. I acknowledge that I'm still a grockle down here and probably always will be in some folks' eyes, but this is where I really do want to spend the rest of my life, embracing the delights of this quintessentially beautiful part of the world, as so eloquently encapsulated in that famous song, "'Tis Devon, Glorious Devon."
David's choice of music, entitled Glorious Devon, is sung by Peter Dawson. This song was composed by Sir Edward German in 1905, and the lyrics were written by Sir Harold Bolton.
Kilmeny tall green meadow and lane, birds on the waving bough, beetling clips by the surging main, rich red loam for the plough. Devon's the fount of the bravest blood that graces England's breed, her maidens fair as the apple bud, and her men are men indeed. Adam and Eve were dispossessed of a garden hard by heaven. They planted another one down in the west. Was Devon, glorious Devon. Spirits of old world heroes wake by a river and a cove and a hole. Gravel, Hawkins, Raleigh and Drake, and a thousand more we know. To every land the wide world owes some slips of the old stock roam. Leal friends in the feast, red foes in war, with a heart still true to home. Old England's counties by the sea from are seven, but the gem of that fair galaxy is Devon, glorious Devon. Dorset, Somerset, Cornwall, Wales may envy the likes of we, for the flower of the west, the first, the best, the pick of the bunch us be. Squaw boy, junket and cider blue, riches of cream from the cow. What did old England without him do, and where did it be to know? As crumby as a lump of lead, be a loaf without good leaven, but the yeast mother England do use for a bread. Be Devon, glorious Devon.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins, John Townsend, Valerie Forrester, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Aileen Clarkson, Harry Sullivan, Fran Frank, and David Quay.
Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. This month's programme was produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Mike Smith and Stephen Taylor. Well, Camilla and I hope you have enjoyed this month's edition of Roundabout. Look after yourself until next time.
Goodbye.